I got to the point where every day I would dread playing because I was like, how many people am I going to embarrass myself in front of tonight? 150, 253. How many people are going to see me make an idiot of myself tonight? You know, and it kind of, that burned me, that bothered me a lot.
You've told another lie this time. You stood up, but your legs aren't moving again. It's your call, but it better be the last try. You hold ransom for tuition that I've already spent. So give it up, give it up.
Welcome back to Label, the stories, rumors, and legends of Tooth & Nail Records. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today's episode is so good. Sometimes my favorite ones of these have an almost tragic what could have been feel, and this is one of those episodes. Capitol Lights came along in the peak of Tooth & Nail's power and influence. And oddly, in this time period, there's many bands who seem to have everything going for them and were musically outstanding, and yet the potential seems to never have been reached. Bryson, in this case, is a truly gifted singer and songwriter. And I've heard praise forever from Brandon and Sprinkle and others over the years, but I've had no personal experience of seeing Capitol Lights play or meeting Bryson, so I really enjoyed getting to hear his perspective of the time he spent in the scene, and I'm sure you will too. Now, don't forget to join the Label Facebook group. I think it's a great place to connect over shared history and interest. Jim Worthen moderates the group really well, and I'd say it's very positive and a healthy place. I love to prepare for the episodes by getting thoughts from people and, you know, informing the conversations that way. And I intend to use it to help shape the direction of the show as we continue to branch out and cover the broader history of our scene. So search for it in Facebook. Say what's up. I'll see you over there. Okay, let's do it. Well, it's really nice to meet you, and thanks for making time today.
Yeah, nice to meet you as well. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, now I know we don't know each other, but we have so much shared context that I'm just going to jump in like we know each other because I think it will feel that way.
Yeah.
And I just want to talk about his favorite Christmas story. It's just, I wish we'd have done this episode before Christmas, but that's just what, you know, that's what comes up. And when I ask people in the Facebook group, I've had people text me and ask about that. I love the song. It's so powerful, and it's just, you know, it's just an interesting thing. So I just want to start with that song, cool. And then we'll jump backwards and talk about, you know, other things. But
yeah,
just tell me the story about that song, because it's like a really, really unbelievable Christmas song, and we'll play it or some of it here. But if you haven't heard it, pause it, listen to this Christmas song, and then jump back into the to this episode.
Nice. Yeah. So we wrote that in 2008. So we signed with Tooth & Nail. We recorded our album in January of 2008. And then our album dropped in July of that year. And right around July, August, I was actually on family vacation with my family to Disney World. And our A&R guy there at Tooth & Nail at the time was named John Dunn. And John called and said, hey, we want to feature Capitol Lights on our Tooth & Nail record that we're releasing. We're doing a, you know, some type of Christmas album that we're releasing in December or just before Christmas. And he was like, you have options. You can either, you know, cover a current Christmas song or you can write your own Christmas song. And we were brand new to the label, and I didn't want to be the only band that decided to cover an old song and look like we were taking the easy route. So I just kind of figured, oh, shoot, I bet everyone's writing their own song. So I just decided to write a song. I remember specifically we were at Animal Kingdom, and I was like, well, I guess my vacation's done because now I'm going to be in my head trying to come up with the song the entire time because I can't really multitask. If I'm trying to write, if I'm stressed about getting something out, then I'm basically just a blank stare walking around doing nothing. So, yeah, I was just like, all right, I'm going to write something. So I remember going back to the hotel there in Orlando and just pacing around the parking lot for a couple hours, just walking around, trying to come up with an idea for a story. And that's how it came about. And I didn't have a guitar with me or anything. And I didn't, you know, back then I didn't have an iPhone or anything to even figure out keys or anything like that. So I just kind of sung it in my head, came up with the story, wrote it down. And then kind of knew just in general what the chord progression would be. And I remember when we came home from that trip in Florida, as soon as I walked in the house, I picked up the acoustic guitar and spent like, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 minutes just like, okay, now I've got the chord progression figured out. We didn't write technical songs. It was probably 4 chords total, but I kind of figured out the chord progression, was like, all right, I've got the basic arrangement now. And then I brought it to the guys and we recorded it here in Tulsa, probably that late summer or early fall, and had it out. And, you know, that Christmas record dropped from Tooth & Nail. And I think most people actually ended up covering some songs, some old Christmas songs. And there were a few of us that did write our own. But I ended up listening to it. And at the time, I was kind of bummed. And I was like, man, I wasted my vacation writing a song when we could have just covered something. But here we are years later. And because of Spotify and these streaming services, this song's still getting listened to, you know, what, 12, 13, 14 years later. So I'm glad we wrote the song now at this point, looking back on it. I'm glad we actually took the opportunity to put some effort into a Christmas song.
It was the night before Christmas, it was love at first sight. The carolers sang as they danced through the night. She was a small town girl, he was a traveling guy. He never caught her name before they said their goodbyes. He was out on the road, having Christmas dinner in a diner alone, when he saw a young waitress with a gleam in her eye. Her favorite day of the year, she showed her spirits were high. She said, sir, can you shed a little hearty cheer? A simple Christmas story is all she wanted to hear. He looked prepared with a smile as he started to say, here's my favorite Christmas story about a girl with no name. He said, I met her up in Delaware.
Have a song come out of a time like that and then last and make it into part of the world's Christmas experience. That's just everything to me. Like, so that's just so cool to start there. And that story just brings a lot of things to mind anyway. One thing is that feeling that being in a band or doing this thing where you know there's a audience out there. The way that impacts your home life, you already gave a great illustration of that, in that you're on vacation and obsessed with this other thing that's elsewhere, and I think people are different. So that's something interesting, and I think it's just fascinating mentally, the process of what you said there of writing, in that you can, like, some people say that's bad, like you can disconnect your body from your mind. Do you know what I mean? But that doesn't sound bad. I mean, it might be, maybe it ruins your vacation. I don't know. But for but for the purposes of being able to go somewhere creatively, that's like you go somewhere else and you have access to be able to come up with something like that. It's like you envisioned a scene. I don't know how you did it, but you know, any of those three things that I'm commenting on there, feel free to take it in any direction, because it's already all fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and I think you're right. So when my brain, when I'm going into writing mode, it's like a, you know, you have to put your brain in that creative mode, and you're like, okay, I'm going to sit here in creative mode, and, you know, you can have the TV on in the background. People can be talking to me, but I'm kind of checked out for the most point. Luckily that happened at the very end of our trip. So we had, like, Animal Kingdom was our last day of all the parks that we went to. And then, you know, we had like another day left in Florida or something. So, but that's kind of how it goes, is we'll shoot, you know, I was having relaxing vacation time and like checking out of being creative, checking off of tour, and just having like a fun family trip. And then at the very end there, it's like, okay, label called. I got to go back into creative mode now. And I'm going to be, I'm still walking around, but I almost felt like I was kind of a zombie at some point, 'cause I'm like trying to come up with a story in my head. But like I said, I look back on it and I'm glad I did it. Glad I put
That's
forth
so
that
cool
effort.
For, it's like, what is the songwriting process? Well, go to Disneyland.
Yeah,
you know, go to the Animal Kingdom, you know.
Right,
but you did. You challenged. I also like the aspect that you challenged yourself in relation to the other. But you know, there's a John Donne character who comes in and gives you the challenge. Do you accept it? And you think in your head, "Oh my gosh, all these other people are going to do so. I have to really rise to meet this." And that produced the focus. That produced. I don't know. That's like something really cool about that.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Go for it. I'm just gonna say, I'm glad we started with the Christmas story, just because we're coming. I mean, it's February now. I feel like Christmas was just a couple weeks ago, but that is, we still have some Christian stations will walk in, like my local grocery store here is called Reeser's. I think they always play Christian music, but walking in there in Reeser's, it's like every December, because I'm there every week grocery shopping, but every December, I swear I walk in there, and if I don't hear it playing, someone from my friend, you know, one of my friends or my family will text me and say, hey, I'm in the grocery store, and your voice is playing over the system singing the Christmas song. So yeah, I'm glad it's lived on. Hopefully it continues to do so.
That's great. And then, yeah, there's some really other good, you know, Christmas songs in that series of, yeah, of stuff from Tooth and Nail. So Tulsa then. So let's just go in the, how does the Tulsa scene, how do you connect to it and it connect to the larger landscape of the scene and everything like that? There's a pretty big history in Tulsa. I love it. You know, I was just there recently. Probably go back again this year. It's a market that I love. It's always fun. And everything there, but it has a pretty good history with this whole scene, you know. How far back do you go with it?
Shoot, probably late 90s. So 98, 99 is kind of when I started getting into playing music. Got overly obsessed with MXPX, where, I mean, that's how I learned to play bass, was listening to MXPX songs with the bass guitar in my hand and trying to figure out how to play all the songs. And back then, so Fillmore was a big Christian punk band in Tulsa. And it seemed like Tooth and Nail bands were always coming through on tour. I was a big fan of Slick Shoes and Ace Troubleshooter, Dogwood, Hangnail. Nice. They were all coming through back in the day. And that was like I said, like 98, 99. That's where, and there was a big scene. I mean, a big scene here in Tulsa. There were shows every weekend, and it was the same group of, you know, every show you went to was a big, you know, the same couple hundred punk rockers that you would see every weekend. And I really, really got into punk rock, got into MXPX was my favorite band. I know they weren't from Tulsa, but they played through here a few times around that time. Got to go see them. And, you know, Capital Light eventually stemmed from, I played bass in another band. I played bass in this other screamo type of rock band. As the time went on, early 2000s, I got more into some of the other Tooth and Nail bands like Under Oath, Anne Boleyn, Emery. I would listen to a lot of that style of music. Started this screamo rock band that I played bass in, didn't sing, and another band or two from the scene. We all kind of came together and formed Capital Lights in 2007. So we just stayed in the scene. We kept playing the shows and eventually became Capital Lights, started with a bunch of scene kids that love punk rock music.
That's awesome. It's just cool to know that it was vibrant there, but all the way back for the 90s, that's like 10 years you were around the thing before you actually started to become a real participant nationally, at least. But you were playing, you were doing creative and collaborative stuff throughout that time.
Yep, definitely. I think that's one of the biggest, you know, when Capital Lights started, one of the things that I think when we look back on it that hurt us is I was burnt out kind of before Capital Lights started. So I had went through 10 years of band drama and band practices every week that would end in arguments and, oh, we got to have another band meeting to talk about, you know, this, this, and this, because we're hearing rumors that someone's doing something wrong, right? So we were always having these band meetings and all this band drama. And again, I was the bass player. I was the bass player back then. And we ended up getting to a point where we had to ask our lead singer to leave from this other band that I was in, not Capital Lights. And I was ready to be done. I wasn't going to play music anymore. I was going to give it up. And I convinced myself, I was like, you know, I think I could write some melodies. I think I could write some songs, some lyrics, some melodies, and actually put forth more effort into making music that people want to listen to. Because my previous band, we were all about screaming and jumping around on stage and putting on a good show. No one ever really wanted to listen to our local CDs that we'd put out. We weren't really focused on making good songs. And so I was like, I'm going to put forth some effort, try to write some good songs. And I wrote two or three songs, showed a couple of the guys, and they were like, we love this. And so me and a couple of guys from my old band partnered with a guy from another band. We all came together, and I think it was the breath of fresh air to me. I was burnt out on playing bass and for the last 10 years and having all this band drama. All of a sudden now I'm the lead singer of a band, and I think it got me a breath of fresh air and got me back into it and wanting it. But I think Capitol Lights was honestly short-lived. We were really only touring for a year and a half because of all the stuff I was burnt out on before Capitol Lights even starting.
That's fascinating. So it's one of the cool things about a scene that there is so many, that it just exists. But since it exists, it's this social world where everybody really cares a lot about it. And yeah, at that level, there's insane amounts of drama. It's kind of weird seeing it from a zoomed out or 20 year perspective. It's like, if there's a band that's been around, the big bands that are around now, like if you see them at the festivals or whatever, just that have been around a long time, they are not full of drama, or you wouldn't make it. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like maturity actually is kind of comes later, but it's the most divas and dramas are at the local band level for sure, without a doubt. It's unbelievable, you know, how dramatic and diva and egos are just out of control at the local level, you know, once there's real, you know, meaning in that social scene. It's the real world, you know.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think when I look back, you know, Capitol Lights, there wasn't really any drama in Capitol Lights. So once we all came together, I became the singer. We put this new band together. We were all happy. And prior to that, when I was in my old band, I had found Aaron Sprinkle's email address, the producer, big time producer, Tooth and Nail Records. He had produced MXPX, Amberlin, all kinds of, I think he did some Emory records. I'd found his email. I'd sent him some songs from our old music, and he would tell me, he was like, "Hey, send me new songs as you get them. Sounds okay." But I could tell he wasn't that impressed, but he kind of saw potential.
Still very encouraging to get response.
Very encouraging. Yeah. We would, every time he would reply, I'd be like, "Oh, he replied again. He doesn't love the song, but he likes it enough to reply." But as soon as I became the lead singer and I wrote like two or three songs, I sent one to him, and he immediately replied that day and was like, "Dude, I love this. Can I send it out to the Tooth and Nail people?" Nice. And that was a dream. I mean, a kid growing up in the scene, loving every Tooth and Nail band I had ever heard. Aaron Sprinkle produced most of the albums I listened to. And like for him to say, "Okay, can I send it to Tooth and Nail people?" I was like, "Oh, here it comes. We're going to start talking to Tooth and Nail." And I, you know, like I said, I was so excited to be in that front man spot all of a sudden where, hey, now I'm the lead singer and we're getting looked at by Tooth and Nail, and it eventually became a few other labels as well. And like I said, it was a breath of fresh air, but I think the fact that I was still young, immature, and I was burnt out from all those previous years, I think is what ended up breaking up a year and a half after that.
Wow. So we got a lot to cover in that year and a half, but that's just awesome. To get the attention of somebody that you respect, that you know has ability and knowledge that you want, is one thing, and then for it to actually be connected to you know, the opportunity itself and the label, that's a really amazing thing. And Sprinkle is, I, you know, that isn't very common for Sprinkle. It's not like he was always developing artists and bringing artists, like he could, but that's not what he was ever focused on. So it's not like he's thinks of himself as, or thought of himself as, an A&R guy. So that, even that's a pretty unique thing in the way things typically work.
Yeah, I remember Brandon saying, Brandon Ebel, once we got in contact with Brandon Ebel, because John Dunn, after Sprinkle sent him that song, John Dunn emailed me the very next day and said, "Hey, love this music Sprinkle sent to me. Would be interested in talking with you." And so we started having phone calls, and they ended up flying us out to Seattle, where I met Brandon. And Brandon even mentioned, he was like, "Hey, this is the first time that Sprinkle's been like an A&R guy and brought me music and said, you got to sign these guys." And, you know, which made us feel even more special. Like, Sprinkle's worked with all these bands, but he loved us enough when we weren't that good, to the point where he told me to stay in contact. And once I sent him something that he loved, he was like, "Hey, I'm going to work on getting you guys signed." So we felt really special for Sprinkle to give us that much attention.
Yeah, that's very cool. Tell me the story about that, coming to Seattle and meeting Brandon.
You know, we went to Seattle in 2007. So they flew me and my buddy Johnny, who was the guitar player, out to perform for them in what they called the pit at the Tooth and Nail offices. And I swear, I remember them telling me, so at the time, these offices were pretty new. And they were like, "Hey, I think we've only had like two or three groups come in and perform for us here." And I'm pretty sure they said Emory was one of them, where they sit you in this this room, and all the Tooth and Nail people were sitting there on bench on a bench, kind of watching us, and we were just kind of sitting there playing songs for them. And we did two or three songs, and I remember Ryan Clark, Demon Hunter, they're all there, just kind of watching, and which was surreal to me to be like, man, all these bands I listen to, Brandon Ebel, John Dunn from Demon Hunter, you know, Ryan Clark, all these guys who I know who they are now interested in hearing something, hearing what I have to say. And, you know, we sit in there and played two or three songs for them acoustic. And it was great. They loved it. And I remember right afterwards, John Dunn saying, "Hey, shoot, I'm ready to send you a contract right now." And which was a great feeling. I was brand new to singing at the time, so I was very nervous coming in. I was only a bass player. So I came in and I'm like, I've never really sang in front of people much other than just
cool
doing
path.
Yeah, I'd always done backup vocals here and there or screamed, but I'd never just sat in front of someone and done an acoustic set. So it was crazy.
I'm so glad you brought that up, and that it's called The Pit, which I guess I'd heard that, but I know exactly what you're talking about, and I'm pretty sure that we're the first band that did that. That was a really insane thing, but it was when we did it was 2003. Or something, and we had our record and sent it in. And at that time, before we were even signed, we would just drive around the country and try to get on shows. And like, we drove to a militia group and just knock on their door and said, "We're here." Oh, wow. Said, "Can we play for you in the parking lot?" And they're like, "No, we can't really exactly. We're not going to sign a band. We're signing this other band, Copeland. We're not looking for new bands, but I don't think we could have you play in the parking lot." But we met them, and that was really cool. But that's the kind of stuff we would do. And then when we had our record, and John Dunn was a friend of ours from the local scene, he took the record in and showed them, and same thing. And it was like, I was like, "Well, we can, you know, we need to." It was like, "We got to find a time when you're playing." We're like, "Well, just can we just come there and play?"
Wow.
You know, and or I don't know if it was our idea or theirs, but it was like, there's got to be a way that they feel like they want to sign us and stuff. They're interested. Yeah. They like the recording, but they want to see us. So let's just do it. And you're used to playing local shows for small crowds, so it doesn't feel that crazy as it would to go backwards. But it's the most intimidating possible environment, if you think about it. It's in the basement of the label with everybody you know, and you know that if you play good, you're going to get signed. And if you don't, you will not. You know what I mean? Like, you could the fact that it's happening means you could easily blow it, or they just don't like what they see, or it sounds fun, whatever it is. So you have to bring your whole you know what I mean, just figure out how to. But we did it and played full band and just all the, you know, jumping around everything. And it was like, you know, the way I remember it is like 22 people leaning against the back wall with their arms folded in a tiny room.
Exactly.
That's the kind of thing. It would be so cool if they would have filmed those or made more of that. It's almost a different type of take on a tiny desk, but from the different point of view, called The Pit. I wish it existed. It could have been.
Oh, true.
You know what I mean? I can just see it as a thing, The Pit, and it's just like that. Oh, you go in there, you either get signed or you don't. And it's the toughest environment. I love that. I'm glad you brought that up. I would like to know who the other bands have done it now that you bring that up, and we'll go back and reconstruct that a little bit. But that is awesome.
Yeah, I wish they had some cameras in there filming. That would be so fun to go back and watch. But you're right. They all set up. Brandon Ebel didn't smile at all the entire time. He just straight face. Same with Ryan Clark. Mm-hmm. I remember Ryan Clark just sitting there with his big beard, just staring at me, like his intimidating look, not even cracking a smile. Whereas John Dunn was our A&R guy. He was the guy that loved it. So he was there kind of like bobbing his head.
You up. Yeah, right,
yeah, he was smiling, you know, made us feel good. But it was intimidating.
But you got sprinkled. Derek Tenbush, John Fraser were there. The people, you know, just like that whole thing.
Yep.
That's crazy. And so they offer the contract, and you just, what happens next? You then go for it.
They sent it to us. So they sent us a contract, and it was really weird. And I don't really know exactly how, I don't know if it was word of mouth or what, but within a couple months, we had like five or six labels looking at us. I remember Flickr was one, and I think that was the name of the label that the Audio Adrenaline guys owned. And they like flew us out to a show and had us come sit on the tour bus, and they talked to us. And there were a few others that we talked to at that. I don't remember. There's a conference in Nashville that we went to, and I don't remember what the acronym is, but it was some big conference in Nashville. We went to, there was a bunch of labels. They would take us out to dinner and talk.
GMA.
Yeah. I knew there was a G in it. And so we had like four or five of them. Most of them, the other labels, we weren't really that interested in. We were very interested in Tooth & Nail because they were the guys that looked like us. They were wearing the hoodies and they were hyped up and excited. Right. And mm-hmm. Brandon was like, oh, I want to break you guys big. And, you know, saying things like that. Whereas the other labels were very like calm and just like, I don't, it wasn't the vibe we were looking for. They did, Atlantic Records flew a guy out who had heard of us somehow, flew a guy out to see us. And it was this guy named Andy something, but he had signed like Korn and a few other big artists. And so he flew out, he watched us play live and he said, hey, it's very obvious that your lead singer is a brand new lead singer. You guys have just kind of got together, work on your stage presence, write more than five songs, right? Write five, six, seven, eight more songs, then call me in 6 months. And at the time we were just too hyped. We were like, we want to sign with Tooth & Nail. Every band we liked is on Tooth & Nail. We love Tooth & Nail. So we just kind of ended up signing with Tooth & Nail. I think the negotiations with the contracts though took like 6 months or so. And then once we got it finalized, we signed, I think in like December of 2007, and we flew out to Seattle January 1st of 2008 to record with Springle. So
nice. What a cool story this is. It got a bidding war. But the thing that's fascinating me now about it is that you did 10 years as a bass player, screamer, whatever, and you just got to be the lead singer. And the second you got the juice there as the lead singer or had the – you seem to have gotten a – new confident, like you said something there, but it seems like you became confident.
But
didn't come from being confident previously. And the second you step into that, it blows up and there's a bidding war for this singer of this writer. All of a sudden it just emerges.
It was crazy. It was so weird too, because like I said, I was burnt out, but I had been in the background being the bass player. As soon as I became the singer and I wrote those two or three songs that we sent to Springle and then we got all this label talk, and then we eventually signed with Tooth & Nail. It was so weird to me because I was like, man, you know, a year ago, I was the bass player of a band wanting to quit. And now I'm the front man of a Tooth & Nail band that like, I'm the front man of the kind of bands that I've been listening to for the last several years and loving and wanting to be. And I had always aspired to be a bass player of a Tooth & Nail band. All of a sudden I became a front man. It was so crazy just to be in the position. I was getting more attention than I'd ever received before. It was nice.
But so that's an out of control moment though. I don't know if you were more grounded from the past experience or just the slingshot of that reversal and momentum, but it sounds really dangerous for a person to be in that position, ego wise and everything else.
Yeah, I know. And I think I was a little too immature. Little might be an understatement. I was too immature to, you know, when we got signed, it was like everything was too great up front all at once, because as soon as we got signed, they're like, you're recording with Springle. Come up here. We're up there. You know, we signed end of December. We were up there January 1st. We recorded our album all of January of 2008. Immediately we come home and like we did a quick, there was like a Tooth & Nail tour that we did like the first leg of. That was a lot of fun. And then immediately after we got put on a tour with Hawk Nelson called the Green Tea Tour. And Hawk Nelson back in that day was attracting, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 probably people a show. And it was all, you know, a bunch of like 15, 16 year old girls, like the ones that scream, and it's the kind of crowd you want, the ones that are there singing along with every song and jumping around. So we got put on this tour with Hawk Nelson and Run Kid Run. You know, a month after we get home from touring or from recording our album. And so it was like we were in heaven. We get to record with Springle. Then we go on this Hawk Nelson tour that lasted 3 months.
If you don't mind, let's just spend whatever amount of time on the recording there before we even go to tour. If you don't mind, because those are two really obvious things that are fascinating. It was you were recording at the compound on Capitol Hill.
Yep.
And it would have been Springle and Randy.
Yeah, Springle and Randy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, that's awesome. That era is just so – I mean, it's the era that I'm really, you know, most familiar with, of course.
Yeah.
And then after Randy left, you know, I wound up in that, you know, spot.
Oh,
I lived
yeah.
down the street and then became, you know, and I did a bunch of records with Sprinkle and it from 2000, you know, late 2008 on, I was doing,
wow.
I was there, you know, running the, doing the engineering and stuff
engineering.
Like that. So, and I remember I'd never run into you guys and didn't have any experience, but as soon as I was in that environment, you know, this was the album that was being talked about and Sprinkle was telling about that recording and this, you know, I'm like,
yeah.
okay, this is where Sprinkle's at as I'm coming in. It's like, this is that sound, that style, that record, that era of Sprinkle is just so brilliant.
Man.
He was in his zone of just incredible genius at
yeah.
that time. And this record, you know, it sounds so good. Is JR mixed it?
JR mixed it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Yeah, it's just that – it's just in the zone of – again, at the time when everything was so big and peak and Sprinkle's focus and everything must have been really good then. I'm curious what that experience was because I wasn't there for it. But
it was crazy. So you probably got there when they opened up the big room then because we were in the small room, which mm-hmm. was great. We
right.
loved, we loved
right.
every moment there. I mean, we would go – they put us up in a hotel down the street from it called, at the time it was called the Pike Street Suites, but I think it eventually got bought out by Hilton or something, but
Homewood
we would,
yeah.
yeah, home, it may have been Homewood. So we would go there and start recording, at like 11 a.m. or something. And we would be there all day. And then I remember we would come home to the hotel every night and just sit in the hot tub for an hour, like just talking about, can you believe we're here, we're all here. And we would hear about other bands. we would hear about other bands who like would split up the recording time. Like the guitar player would go in and record his parts and the drummer would be there before everyone else. And then a week later, the vocalist would come in. But this was, I mean, we were all there at one time, all four of us. And we were loving every single moment and just being in the studio with Sprinkle and watching mm-hmm. him come up with all of his creative ideas. And
what
so,
was
yeah.
that like? What was the, you would work together in the room, y'all would play and have everything out and be talking about the songs.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And then what was Sprinkle, what would he do that? What was the process like?
He would sit. So we did the pre-production where we went in full band, just recorded a quick track of all 10, 11 tracks, however many there are. I think like 11 tracks on there. And for the pre-production, he would listen to it. And I one of my favorite parts about it was we have a song called Outrage. That's the very first song on the album. When we played it in pre-production, there were all these like breaks where going into the bridge, we would all ring out and I would sing a little something and then we would all come back in and then we would ring out and I would sing a little something else. There was all this silly stuff that Sprinkle, he brought us in there into the control room afterwards and he was like, see this whole section? And he like highlighted it and clicked delete. And he was like, you don't need any of this. And he was like, he was just giving us advice on, you don't want a 2-minute bridge of vocals coming in and out and coming in and out. And he was just showing us like, here's how you make, if you want a song that people want to listen to over and over, if you want a song that you want to go on the radio, it needs to be this length. You need to be coming in singing by this moment. And he was very good about crafting and arranging our songs. And some of the songs he was like, hey, you did great. No change. Let's just keep it how it is. And then we'll work, you know, as we record, we'll come up with new ideas. But one of my favorite parts was the basic arrangement during pre-production where he would cut out little bits and pieces of our song or say, hey, mesh this. What you're saying here at the end of the bridge, say it at the beginning, then we're going to cut the rest of it out and go straight into the last chorus. Mm. Just him going and just fixing all the things that we could have done better was one of my favorite parts.
Yeah, that's validating in that if you can get to where you trust somebody and they can just make these sweeping observations, that's hard to get that.
Yeah.
But if
yeah.
you can find the person that you trust enough to do that and they get it on multiple layers and see what you're doing lyrically and then tie that with the music later and have the understanding of the whole and they're telling you the negative stuff, fine, but that's because they are zoning, you can feel them zoning in on the positive parts that you know are there.
Yeah.
And that feels good, you
yeah.
know.
Oh yeah,
it feels
definitely.
Good to be validated that there's stuff worth cutting because there's stuff worth keeping.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And having someone like Sprinkle, you know, like I said, I'd been listening to his albums for so long and even his band Fair. So yeah, we all went in there trusting Spring Gold. We knew whatever advice he was going to give, we were going to listen. And I think another one of my favorite parts. So as you know, we record drums, then we do the guitars and the bass, and then vocals. And so Sprinkle would be there talking me through when I would do the lead vocals. And then the harmonies, I remember specifically, he was, for when it came time to do the harmonies, he would say, "Hey, I'm going to go walk around. Randy's taking control right now." And he would just go walk around the block and he would say, "Put harmonies wherever you think they should go. And I'll come back and I'll listen with the fresh ear and tell you whether those are good or not." So he would come back and I would record all the harmonies and he would come back and say, "Sounds good. That's where they need to be." Or he'd say, "You don't need to do the entire second verse in harmonies. Let's space it out and just harmonize on a couple words here and there." You know, he would come and just kind of fix it. We loved that. And then one of my favorite things that he would do afterward is when he adds like little piano here, tambourine here, little keyboard sounds here, that like the cherry on top, we always called that sprinkling. So to this day, any song I've ever written or recorded with my buddies, when we do it at the end, I'm like, "All right, it's time to sprinkle it now," because we're adding all the little cool noises, all the little subliminal things that most people probably don't catch, but it fills in the song and makes it better. Mm-hmm. We still refer to that as sprinkling the song, which is what I think he was best at.
Yeah, well, that's the most exciting thing, like, because there's the part where there's cutting and then this and that, but the part where you just see his generative creativity come out that came from, no, you cannot imagine where it came from.
Oh, yeah.
Because you wouldn't have thought of it in 100 more lifetimes, whatever.
Right.
But, and it's minor or this thing, and, you know, but that's the, and it's just in spots. And the weird thing about him is, not the weird thing, I guess the powerful, you've done a better job than I've ever heard of, you know, explaining what he really does or is capable of in that regard, but because it's making me think about it differently. And it's that he is always able to attain perspective from the outside.
Yeah.
Like, he does not get lost in anything. He'll go around the block. He'll stop paying attention. There's so many times when I thought, he's not paying attention at all. This is not good. And then he's like doing something else, and you can tell he's doing something else, but he really does that. I mean, I'm sure he has attention issues or whatever, but it's using that as a gift, because when you're tuned out or have a different perspective, and then what you notice is the thing that bumps him back into attention or whatever. So it's really skilled way of always maintaining a fresh perspective and not being lost in any of the details. And he doesn't have any process ever really that I could tell. I mean, the things you're saying are familiar, but it's not like a way you record things. It does not even exist to him at all. It's just maintaining perspective and reacting to it. And whether it's cutting or anyway, that's a really poetic and well, organized way of explaining that process. That's really awesome. And it resulted in just an awesome, you know, album that tons of people like and still listen to. I mean, you know, you've got songs with millions of streams on these songs.
Right. Yeah. It blows my mind to this day. One of the songs that we get most plays on is called Mile Away. And that was where Sprinkle shined most, because there's not much guitar or anything on it. It's mainly keyboard sound, synthesizer. Even the drums for the most of the song is all synthesizer drums. And so I sat there with an acoustic guitar, sang him the song one time. And again, it's called Mile Away, and there's not a lot to it. It's a pretty empty song. But I played it for him one time, acoustic guitar, and he goes, "What are those chords again?" And I told him, and he goes, "Get out of my control room." So he kicked us out. He said, "Give me an hour." And he built Mile Away. I mean, all the bass, all the synth, all the piano, everything, the drums, everything you hear on that song, he built it. And then said, "All right, come in, record your vocals." And I mean, it was it's a very 80s sound almost, but even the beat that he put on it was a little weird for me. Like, I had trouble singing to it at first, but now I look back on it, and love it. Love everything that he did with it. It was so creative. funny thing about it is years later, a bunch of rappers used my chorus that I sang on that song and put it on their songs. One of them being Wiz Khalifa, who ended up breaking it huge. Wiz Khalifa is huge now, but he used my, he sampled my voice from Mile Away and put it on his song called Miles. We in our own world. Yeah. I know they gonna feel me on this one. Years ago, but still, cool thing that I'm on a Wiz Khalifa track.
Very cool. How did that work financially, or permission, or what does all that do?
I don't know how he got permission. We had a few rappers that reached out to me. I mean, I think there's been three rappers total that used it, but we just always said, hey, talk to Tooth and Nail. And I think he probably did the same, but he never sold any of the music. He just put it on a mixtape and released it for free. So I don't even know what permissions he has to get for that. But
that's, I guess maybe that's what's cool about mixtapes is when you're not, you know, that's that whole, that birth of that thing that's so common now just on TikTok or everything else where you just kind of, there's a sampling and remixing going on. That's what, I mean, I guess that's what all this culture and art even is. But it's like really, you know, when you can untether the money from it, you know, more stuff can happen. You can spread it and all that. So it's kind of cool, but also kind of sucks that there's no money that your music gets used. But does that suck? I mean, not really, right? Do you feel owed?
Nah.
You wish it was different?
Nah, not really.
Yeah, I don't think I would.
I'm good. No.
Yeah.
I just think it's cool. I think it's cool.
But still, there is this feeling like with that amount of what this all is, it still feels like, man, how are we going to get from where we are now to it's over?
And we're,
you know, that's the feeling I have in the conversation up here. Yeah. But I told you we'd have a lot of shared experience.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, so go ahead.
No. Whatever you're going to say, do it.
No, I was going to say, so we were there for about a month, came home, maybe had a week break. And then that's when we headed out on the tours.
Okay. That was awesome. I just happened to have particularly vivid memories and everything of that exact situation and everything. So that, thank you for that. Another thing I want to bring in too, and then we'll go to tour, if you'll take a whole nother detour, is how would you explain your interface as a Christian band and where you were seeing that whole part of the spectrum of spiritual and, you know, the mix of the commercial and spiritual and the crossover markets or Christian band and just whatever that is. What was your interface for that?
I mean, it's the same thing that I feel like a lot of people said back then is we're Christians in a band. Obviously no cussing or anything like that in the songs. We didn't want to be, I know worship music is huge nowadays. There's worship bands that are huge. Back then, I, you know, Hillsong was probably pretty popular at the time. I was never into worship music personally. That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to play music that I listened to, which was, you know, the punk rock type style of music. Most of our songs were probably about girls and everyday life. We did have some songs that were more strictly focused on Christian. I think Tooth and Nail, specifically Brandon Ebel, had told me afterwards, like, hey, man, I wish you would have wrote more of your album, pretty much most if not all the album, with more Christian lyrics, because you would have done much better about getting radio play with like Air One and, you know, some of the, and you could have potentially made it, you know, bigger onto the next level. Like some of the other bands out there, but I just, you know, I never did. I really saw it as, yeah, we're a Christian band. We all grew up Christian. We grew up listening to Christian music for the most part, but it's not worshipy lyrics. It was just more positive. And, you know, some songs were strictly Christian. Most songs were not. They were just general everyday songs about girls, breakups, what have you.
But that's because, I mean, part of the reason that would have felt weirder is because you did come from a scene of something that had its own norms and values. So that would have been doing something that would have felt like to do that would have felt weird.
Yeah, definitely.
But interesting that the opportunity presents itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we went on tour with, or not to get into the tour yet, but Hawk Nelson, when we saw them, you know, I think they're a good example of, they had this perfect mix of, really good Christian songs that were very Christian, and then also like the pop punk songs about girls and everyday life. And they had, you know, I think they were very successful at that. I think we didn't really hit the nail on the head with that because we were mostly just, you know, singing songs like what Fall Out Boy or, you know, most of those mainstream bands would do with two or three songs that were more very strictly Christian. So
there was a even that was a choice to be doing the Christian lyrics must have been pretty important to you.
Yeah.
You know, because we're not talking about, like you said, the mainstream bands, but, you know, you also could have conceivably, we could be talking more about Warped Tour and stuff like that versus the, you know, Hawk Nelson and the church, you know, the Christian songs in the churches and the GMAs,
right?
Those things.
Exactly. Yeah. I was really big. And the album that, if you're familiar with My Chemical Romance, The Black Parade, that album came out.
I think we are.
I think y'all are. Yeah. I think that album came out probably 2000, maybe five, probably maybe 2006. I don't know when it was, but that album's the one that I would sit in my car and just scream and sing along. And that was the album that really encouraged me and kind of gave me the confidence that, hey, our lead singer's leaving the band. We had to kick him out, but I'm going to write some songs. I think I can write some songs that are, I think I've got an okay enough voice to sing, and I'm going to write some melodies. And I was really listening to bands like The Used and, you know, The Black Parade, My Chemical Romance, stuff like that back then. And that's kind of really what I leaned towards with lyrics. But again, I've grown up Christian, and I did have some songs that were very more along the lines of Christian lyrically, but for the most part, it was more of a mainstream type style.
But was it important to you to be in the Christian space as a band, like
it was.
Be outspoken? What
you
know? How would you? What language would you have used? Outspoken?
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, it was, and we would usually talk about it from the stage a little bit here and there. You know, we always tried to make a point that even when we were playing, you know, we would do tours where we were playing mostly in bars, and we were always in my previous band too, always trying to make a point that say, hey, you know, we're a godly band, we're a Christian band. And, you know, if any of you have any questions, anyone want to talk about it, anyone want to pray about anything, come see us after the show. We're happy to pray with you, talk with you. We always tried to make a point to say something along those lines. And it was important to be, you know, a Christian band, but at the same time, it didn't always translate lyrically through most of our songs.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the touring direction then is that you consider it somewhat of the crossover between the clubs and the churches and the things like that. So you get the Tooth and Nail tour. What were the bands on that?
Oh,
which one was that? The MXPX one?
No, it was a smaller Tooth and Nail tour. So it was Children 18-3, who had just got signed right around the same time as us, maybe a little earlier. Dismas, although I don't remember if Dismas were signed to Tooth and Nail. We called it the Tooth and Nail tour. I don't know what the actual name was. Do you know if Dismas were signed to Tooth and Nail?
I don't know.
Okay. They were the headliners. It was us, Children 18-3, Dismas, and a couple other bands. We refer to that as the Tooth and Nail tour. The more I think about it, I don't know what the actual name of the tour was, but yeah, that was like a 2 week. We did one quick leg on it, and then went from
there. In bars.
Yeah, a lot of it was bars, or very small venues, and then we went from that. We hopped from that straight to the Hawk Nelson tour, which were bigger shows.
Okay, and what were those venues like? You said they were really big, but what were they?
Yeah,
like?
So I mean, I think most crowds were probably, so a lot of them were like mega church, like those big churches that you see that have the big auditoriums and they'd pack them out, big theaters. Most shows I would say probably averaged 1,500 to 3,000 people. Wow. That's what I would get. That's what I would gauge. And it was big. I mean, Hawk Nelson, I remember at the time saying for them to be headlining, it was bigger than anything they had done up until that point. So,
and the biggest shows you'd played are what before that?
Biggest shows we'd play. I don't know, maybe 400 or 500 people that ever, because we'd played
in
Tulsa. Yeah. So we had mainly just played in Tulsa and played maybe a few shows, 400 or 500 people.
Golly.
Yeah. So we got to jump, make a big jump. And yeah, it was awesome. And like I said, we were in heaven. It was almost like too much good happened at once. And we were like, oh,
it's crazy.
Yeah. And, Go ahead.
So we're back at the how can your ego handle such things? Right. How, what is that? I can't even, you know, you're in the hot tub after the recording session.
Yeah.
You're going to do some warm-up shows, and now you're doing this.
And now we're doing this, and man, it was, you know, every show was so much fun. We were in, you know, Run Kid Run on that tour had been touring for many years, and they were kind of burnt out. At that point, they were like, oh man, we want to get back to some more punk rock show. Because at the time they were, you know, that tour was the first tour where we had had like in-ears and a click track and, you know, tracks that would play through like the you know, the piano and all mm-hmm. the tambourine and all that stuff. We had never been at that professional level. So we loved it. Whereas Run Kid Run, they were like, man, we miss the old punk rock days when like you had the monitors just blaring loud and no one had any in-ears in and there was no click track. And so Run Kid was at this place where they had been doing this for a few years, this more professional in-ears setup, and they were ready to get back to the old school ways, whereas we had just gotten out of the old school ways, and we're like, oh man, this is amazing. I can't believe how professional this is. We've got in-ears and like battery packs in our back pocket, and I can hear my vocals clearly, and everything sounds great.
Are you traveling on a bus, or you have a crew? What do you have?
We had a van, so we were traveling on uh-huh. a van. We were the only band that didn't have a bus on that. It was just the three bands. So traveling in a van, but loving every minute of it. Every show was great.
Did you hire your road crew though?
Nope. Okay. It was just yeah. Cool. No, but they Hawk Nelson's in-ears guy, Ed, he worked our in-ears. The same guy that ran John from Hawk Nelson ran our in-ear mixes. Ed ran front of house. And they would help us load stuff in and out, even though they didn't have to. But they had a crew working that would just try to help us too. But we would always tell them, like, hey, we're not used to this. We've never had roadies. We can do our own stuff. But, man, it was just awesome. And after every single show, it was our first experience at standing at a merch booth and signing CDs and signing t-shirts mm-hmm. and spending an hour at the merch booth, just like almost feeling like we're famous. It was so weird. It was so weird to go from a local band all of a sudden being on this big tour where people are buying your shirts and asking you to sign it. And I don't know, it was a crazy experience.
So that brings money then at that point. So we've talked about the Christianity and the creative and all that. So, and now there's this actual size and the fame, but also what's your orientation commercially? I mean, do you start to be ambitious or think, oh, well, in a few years we'll have the bus and we'll make a bunch of money? It seems like it's all happening.
Yeah. That's exactly how we felt. We were like, oh, you know, we're on our way. You know, the band as a whole made pretty good money that tour. But, you know, most of that goes back into gas and all the expenses. And then we put a little bit, you know, we were able to pay ourselves a little bit each day as well to like spend on food and all. But yeah, I mean, we wanted to be the next Hawk Nelson. And we were like, shoot, this is going to be us in a few years. And we're going to have our own tour bus. And we're going to be headlining big tours like this. And the Hawk Nelson guys kind of became like family along with Run Kid Run, because we were on that tour for 3 months. So we were with them every day, and they were very down to earth. They weren't like the headlining band that just hangs out on the bus and doesn't see you at all. You know, they were with us all day long, and we were out doing whatever. Some of the guys from Hawk Nelson would be like, they would give up their bunks on the bed to us, and they would go ride in the van with us. They were like, dude, this reminds me of the old days. So like John, I know John specifically, I slept in his bunk one or two times while he went and drove our van overnight and was like, dude, this is awesome. This is like taking me back to the old days of driving all night while the other buses are driving. So yeah. And you know, our goal was we wanted to be like Hawk Nelson next.
Wow. Yeah. That's really cool. And I can feel that about Run Kid Run being in that environment, because there's something about that environment that is everything is so nice mm-hmm. and you feel almost famous, and there's something about it that's so clean that you yearn for a dirtier or something.
Yeah.
Something you know, you can feel that cleaner environment that is like that's slightly different, that you can have too much of it, you know. But man, it's a right. nice environment.
Yeah, it is
really nice.
Yeah,
really nice. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say we got spoiled to it for 3 months. And I think what Run Kid Run missed was they liked having the monitors blaring, no in-ears, mm-hmm. and the crowd up against the stage. Mm-hmm. And it's a very low stage where you're right there. everyone's screaming with you and you're singing along. Now we're in these a higher stage. The crowd is a little further back, and we've got in ears in. It just does. It doesn't feel the same. So to them, they were like, "Dude, I want to get more punk. I miss some of the older like style." Whereas to us, we had never been in anything this professional. It was, you know, it was brand new and awesome to us.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so what? How could it possibly go wrong from there?
I think it was too good. So we get off that tour, and we did our own headlining tour right after that, called the Onstage Outrage Tour, West Coast, and it was actually pretty good. I think we had maybe every show ranged from 150 to 300 people. I think we had one show that broke 400. We were proud. We were like, "Hey, as a brand new Tooth and Nail band whose album just came out in July of that year." So at this point, it was probably album had just come out a month or two before this. We were like, "Hey, we're doing good. This is great. It's fun." One of the things I was learning as a headliner is that we had to play a longer set, and my voice, I suddenly realized, shoot, I wrote these songs in a high key and I'm having to belt and I'm losing my voice much quicker than I had ever anticipated. I would blow out my voice. So every night was a struggle. We even talked about, lowering, we talked about going down, like tuning down like a half step or so, but all of our tracks that we would use were up at the key that we had recorded in. So we ended up not doing it, but I would blow out my voice, honestly, almost every night. By like fourth or fifth song, I was struggling. So that was one of the things that I got to the point where every day I would dread playing, because I was like, how many people am I going to embarrass myself in front of tonight? 150, 253. How many people are going to see me make an idiot of myself tonight? You know, and it kind of.
Oh, wow.
That burned me. That bothered me a lot.
Oh, really. I that sounds horrible. Like, yeah. the self-talk part of that, like if you find yourself in a position to dread your show.
Yeah.
That's not going to be good.
It's not going to be good. And we did the Creation Tour at the end of that year. So the Onstage Outrage Tour was great. We liked it. We had a lot of fun. Aside from me blowing out my voice every night, we were pretty encouraged, and we were like, "Hey, for our first headlining tour, we're getting pretty good sized crowds." They put us on Creation Tour, which had 9 bands. We were the first of 9. And the thing that really bothered us, and this is a lot of immaturity as well on us, but we had a really bad attitude because all the flyers, all the advertising would say doors open at 6 p.m. and we would play at like 5:40. So we would play before it was advertised that doors were open. And we had a 15-minute set, and we would play. And this tour was 2 months long. It was 2 months long of us every night just getting kind of ticked off. We're like, "Why are we, no one's in here yet." But the guy that was a stage manager was very demanding and was like, "Every minute you go late, you pay us $25. And it was very
horrible.
Yeah, it was crazy. So we would go out and play, and you would see people starting to come in for most of the shows. Some of the shows were great. There were some shows that like it was advertised correctly, and we were playing 30 minutes after the doors open, and it felt good, and there was a good sized crowd. We even got called in. I don't remember the name of the guy who ran the Creation Tour, but it felt like we got called into the principal's office because he had heard we had some bad attitudes about it and kind of told us, "Hey, a lot of bands that you've heard of," I remember him specifically saying, "Hey, a lot of the bands that you've heard of probably wouldn't even be big if it wasn't for Creation. So you need to get your, you need to get your attitude in order." And, I remember calling my dad and being like, "This is it. I'm coming out of this. I'm
That's
dropping up."
Terrible.
And you know, if I hadn't had those 10 years of being burnt out before this, I think I would have handled it better.
I don't think so. I'm going to disagree about that narrative slightly. I'm just saying those two experiences back to back from where you were, it's just, to me, it just, because I didn't know any of this, but just all hinges on, well, if it's not fun, how did you get that? Like, if the only reason you did anything ever or dealt with all the band drama in the first place is because of how fun it was.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So you've dealt with a ton of worse stuff for the last 10 years or whatever, but it was fun.
Yeah.
But if your headlining set isn't fun, like in that way, and a tour like this to be treated like that, because that treatment's horrible. That's not normal at all.
Yeah.
It should not ever happen or have ever happened.
Yeah.
You know, and some of those things and organizations and ways can be that way. But that's not even how it is in the real world with the bigger. That's not how it is in any. That's it should not be how it is.
Yeah.
That type of way.
Yeah. And I tell you, all the bands on that, I could name the bands, but they everyone felt the same way. It was a very weird tour. Like I said, you have to start on the dot when your time goes. And we had 15 minutes. Other bands had longer. But they said 2-minute breakdown. Once you get to minute number three, it's $25 per minute.
That's insane.
Crazy. It's crazy.
I mean, that should make you go insane. And, you know, it's like, but I mean, I don't know. But the loss of fun.
Yeah,
is a big loss if that's the only reason you do stuff. And the people like you probably are propelled by fun.
Right.
You know, like interesting, exactly. New, fun things. If it's not fun, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
That's particularly two really painful situations to be in.
Exactly. And we did, you know, after that, we did maybe one or two more tours. I think maybe just one. And we were headlining again. It was fun. It was the same story as last time, though. I just find myself blowing out my voice, realizing that I'm almost more of a studio singer than I am a front man for a band, because I just can't keep my voice on stage. I'm surprised I haven't lost my voice talking to you today. I lose my voice a lot to this day. My dad does too. So I don't know if it just runs in the family or what, but I don't know that I was ever meant to be a lead singer of a band that's going to tour just because I couldn't keep my voice. But and it bothered me a lot more than it, you know, the other guys in the band, they were like, shoot, it doesn't matter. We're a rock band. Just scream through it. Just, you know, sing through it, whatever. It killed me. I hated losing my voice every single night. And which is one of the things after we did our next tour and that happened again, repeatedly every single night, you know, I started telling the guys, one, I'm not having fun with this. And two, you know, we weren't making, I'd had a full-time job since I was 15 years old. I would still go to high school, but during the summers, I would work a full-time job. During the school year, I'd work part-time. I'd always had my own money coming in. It was weird now having to kind of see, okay, how much money did we make, and basically getting enough money each day to eat out at Wendy's or, you know, something. You know, I wanted to be able to make more money, and I was 24 years old. I wanted to move out of my parents' house and get a real job, so to speak. And you know, I felt like at 24 years old, looking back now, I was very young, but at the time I thought that I needed to get my life in order and, you know, get out of playing in a band and get a real job.
Get your life in order.
Yeah. And I would see other people that I graduated high school with, they would be married with kids already. And they'd always say the same thing, be like, hey, do you still play in a band? And mm-hmm. That question would kill me, because I'm like, yeah, but it's better. It's not like it was in high school. We're on a label, you know, we've got CDs in stores, you know, and that no one would really get it. And I think I just talked to myself too much mentally and brought myself down.
It still feels like it's in your first record cycle, but by that time, it seems like you would have been able to see more money and other opportunities that you would have had based on what you had just accomplished in doing those tours with the record. Like, you had sowed seeds that were really valuable that you had not harvested whatsoever.
Right.
But was there, and so it, maybe you couldn't, a lot of times bands can't feel that, it takes a while before it really kicks in all that you invest the first couple of years of exposure and stuff. It just takes a while. But were there, was the label and other people trying to show you there's more stuff to do?
Yeah. They were, and like I said, I remember talking with Brandon and John, and just talking a little bit about how I felt, and they were trying to be encouraging. You know, we would, there was, so Thousand Foot Crutch was one of the bands that we toured with on Creation. We got to know those guys. Trevor, the lead singer of Thousand Foot Crutch, he was texting me because he had heard that we were considering quitting, and he was trying to talk, you know, he was like, man, I think you're a very good songwriter. You know, I want the band to stay together. I love you guys. If you don't stay together, I think you should at least continue writing and, you know, maybe trying to write for other band. He was very encouraging. And my other bandmates felt like you did. Like, hey, look at all this stuff we just accomplished. Where, you know, where are we going to be 3 or 4 years down the line? You know, we could be the guys in the tour bus. And to me, I couldn't get past blowing out my voice. And I also I was too impatient, immature, and thinking I don't have 3 or 4 years. You know, I almost wanted to get it now or I'm done. You know, my 10 years of being burnt out previously, I think kind of led into that. And just, you know, I was burnt out already. I got this breath of fresh air with me being a new lead singer and getting all this attention from labels and people. But now I'm feeling burnout again, and, you know, a year and a half later. And so, I was ready to go. It eventually got to the point where I think my bad attitude rubbed off, and my brother played drums in the band, and it got to the point where he was ready to quit too, and he didn't have any interest. And the rest of the guys were like, what's going on? You know, wanted to keep going. And but eventually we just decided, I got everyone on the same page that the band would break up in the summer of 2009. And so we played Cornerstone was our last show. We got to play main stage, which was cool at Cornerstone to play main stage. It was earlier in the day, so it wasn't like a headlining main stage event, but we got to play main stage. And I got to blow my voice out in front of a lot of people for my last show, but it was cool. I still look back on this and think, man, that was a crazy year and a half that I got to do what a lot of people don't get to do, you know? So it's, I'm very happy that we get to do it.
Wow. It says, if it's accurate on the Wikipedia, but it says that he said, we all felt God had different plans for our lives. It would have been impossible to pursue those plans while continuing with the band.
Yep.
So tell me more about those plans.
Yeah. And so at the time, like I said, I didn't like not having money. I had, at the time I had a girlfriend who had graduated the same year as me at high school. She was a nurse, and I felt like, man, I'm playing in a band making no money at all, hardly, and she's making good money, and all of my other friends who had graduated high school at the time, they were all, you know, they all had careers, and I just felt like I needed to provide, and I needed to be able to make a living and move out of my parents' house and all. And so I kind of felt like God was leading me in a different direction. And my brother felt the same way. And then my the other bandmates, Johnny, he actually mentioned, like, hey, I'm feeling called to go and work for, you know, his pastor at the time was starting a new church. And he was like, I feel called to go. And he's asked me to come and help him start this new church. And he's still there today. To this day, he's still working there. And so we really did feel like God was leading us in different directions. I think it just all stemmed and started from immaturity, a bad attitude from my end, and saying, hey, I'm done. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And once that happened, I think people started looking other directions and started feeling, hey, okay, if we're ending, I do feel like God's calling me in this direction. Then we just didn't want to get into all the gritty details when we broke up and announced it on whatever MySpace or whatever we announced it on back in those days.
Yeah. I think it says MySpace. It's really cool. Just, I don't know, that's just a really cool even time of what communicate. And, you know, a lot of bands get back together or whatever it is, but were you resolute and stayed resolute in that way? Like, you didn't want to continue to even be a studio or writer? You have done some of that.
For the longest time, I didn't. I didn't listen to the radio. I sold my bass. I didn't listen. I was so, all my friends still bring this up. They're like, hey, remember that time when you hated music? Because I was so just like, didn't want to listen to music, didn't want to talk about music, didn't want to listen to anyone's new band coming out. I was done with music, and probably for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And then, so Neil Endicott, he's from Run Kid Run. He was their guitar player, one of their songwriters. He and I ended up becoming really good friends. He lives in St. Louis. I'm in Tulsa. and we would travel back and forth to each other's houses and write. We wrote tons of songs over the years after that, mainly country music. But yeah, we wrote tons of songs. It felt good to get back to, you know, being in a studio and producing songs and songwriting and all. So I'm not a hater of music altogether anymore, but there for a while, didn't want anything to do with it.
The country plays some weird place in almost everybody's musical evolution when you go in. I mean, it's really, really common to go into the thing you're doing and get oversaturated with it or have whatever experience that you don't have the same perspective anymore. And then a time where you're slightly averse to the whole thing.
Yep.
And then at that moment, it seems that country has an appeal,
yeah.
You know, or folky, like something that's the opposite of what,
yep.
You know, that you previously had a sensitivity to. Now you're more warm. It's like another way re-entry back into being a fan again or being drawn into something.
Exactly. He and I both felt the same way. Country music, I felt like we had to put a little more effort into our lyrics and writing a story, because with rock music, it's like, shoot, you have people that listen to songs that you could listen to a Fall Out Boy song or Panic at the Disco or My Chemical Romance, and you listen to a verse or a chorus and you're like, I don't even know what they're talking about, but that's okay. I'm still going to sing along with it. Country, you really have to tell a story. You have to be very thoughtful with your lyrics. It was a big challenge for us to actually go out and write these country songs and put a little more effort and a bigger challenge to us to actually try to write good, storyful, storytelling songs. So, and he and I both loved it. We haven't done it in years, but we did, you know, we probably wrote 2 5 song EPs for country. Yeah.
Wow. And then how did we get to the 2012 album then?
So that album,
Rhythm and Moves.
Yeah, Rhythm and Moves. I wrote that in 2010 because we had received the letter that Tooth & Nail was picking up an option for a second album. I wrote that just in my downtime in 2010 and thought, we'll probably never record this, but I'm just going to write it in case we decide to do so. I wrote it in 2010 and sent Brandon and I think Randy, who was our engineer in the studio, had ended up becoming like an A&R guy at Tooth & Nail.
That's right.
So Randy, I ended up sending it to Randy, a few songs. He sent it to Brandon, and Brandon was like, hey, if you guys want to record an album, I can send you, Bryson, to Sprinkle, and you can do vocals with him, and we can have studio musicians play the songs. And I was like, well, I don't even really want to do that. If I'm going to do a Capitol Lights album, I want the band to be with me. And I said, why don't we just record it here in my house and we'll have it professionally, you know, mixed and mastered. And he was like, okay. And I said, very small budget. Give me, you know, whatever it was, a couple thousand dollars probably. It was nothing. And he was like, well, if you can do it for this much money, let's do it. And so we recorded it in our house in 2012, I think, and released it. And be honest with you, when I look back on our music, when I think of Capitol Lights, I think of our first album, This Is an Outrage. That's the true Capitol Lights. The second album was almost, it was just kind of thrown together. And, you know, we wrote the songs. So we kind of, you know, once I had written like 10 or 11 songs, I was like, well, shoot, now that I've written this many, I want to record it. So we just kind of threw it together. There was no producer other than just ourselves producing it and done in our house. And, you know, it is what it is. There's a couple good songs on it that I still like, but when I look back on it for the most part, I think it's lacking compared to our first one, to be completely honest.
I mean, there's still some popular songs on it, you know.
Yeah.
There is Say Hey has over 2 million on Spotify. And,
yeah.
And Let Your Hair Down, you know, has 1.5 million on Spotify. So,
oh, good. I didn't know that.
That's bit like it seems still, you know, like,
yeah,
still worth doing from my point of view.
Yeah.
Not, you know, like, I'm glad you, there's a lot of people glad you made that, did that. You seem to speak of it almost unfavorably, but you know what I mean? I don't get it.
At the time, we were more excited about it. At the time, we thought, oh, shoot, this is going to be a great second album. It's just as good or better than our first. It wasn't until years later when I looked back on it, when I kind of thought it was lacking, but we had a lot of fun doing it. We, like I said, we threw it together, but we enjoyed it. We enjoyed the process. It was fun to be doing Capitol Lights again. And, you know, just mm-hmm. throwing together songs. And, you know, there's some song, that Say Hey song you mentioned, there's some cheesy things in it that I wish I wouldn't have done, because we just kind of took almost, we were just like, let's have as much fun as possible. And we'll even throw some silly lyrics in that, you know, who cares? It's just a fun album. And now I look back on it, I'm like, it was a little bit immature, but you know, it was fun. I'm glad that people are liking it and still listen to some of the songs. But Brandon Ebel called me last year out of nowhere. Haven't talked to Brandon since 2009. He called me and was like, "Hey, I know I was really mad at you guys when you put out the second album because you didn't want to tour it, but I've been listening to it lately and I really like it," which is crazy for Brandon to call me and tell me that. But yeah, so I'm excited. I'm glad we did it. The heart wasn't in it as much as it was the first.
Yeah, I understand. That's cool. Brandon is, he really is a real fan of this stuff. He really notices what he really likes and notices it, you know, he's really good at that. So, that's really cool to hear that story. That was just I still don't understand why you did made it. You just like being in the studio. That's worth it to you because you still have the strive to write.
I had the strive to write at the time. So, like I said, when the band broke up in 2009, I didn't do anything. I didn't really listen to music or anything. And I said the wrong year earlier. I said 2010, 2011, I think is when I wrote the album. But when we received the letter that said Tooth & Nail is exercising our option to pick up another album, I took that as, well, if we're going to do it, then I'm just going to start writing. I didn't even think we were going to do it, but I wrote one song, then I wrote a second, wrote a third. By the time I had 7-8 songs down, I was like, well, now I want to record a second album because I've got enough songs. So I just ended up writing 10 songs or so. And the other guys were down. They were like, heck yeah. You know, no one was ready to tour. We all had our own careers at that point. We all had real jobs. So no one wanted to tour, but we were all like on the same page, like, well, shoot, if Tooth & Nail wants us to record, we'll record here at the house and put it out and see if people like it.
Yeah, because that still was, you still had the drive to do that. But another element that seems missing is fans. Like, it seems like, I know you have fans today and always have, but it doesn't sound like you ever really got a lot of connection with them. Like you didn't, it didn't feel like you, if you, sometimes you have the audience feel connected, you feel like, well, we've got to do it for the fans.
Yeah. We did. And I liked meeting them most on our two headlining tours that we did, just because we had like the hardcore fans who knew all the lyrics to our songs would come out. We would have people they would be from like Tennessee and they would follow us to like 5 different shows in the Midwest because, you know, they liked us a lot. We did have connections to fans. It was, you know, I've said this a few times, but every day of a show, I was in a, I don't want to say a bad mood, but I was kind of a downer before every show because I was just like, wow. It's hard for me to connect with people and say, hey guys, you're about to go watch me embarrass myself and blow my voice out by song number 3. You know, I just felt I would get into my head so much about that I could never, I don't remember one show that I was up on stage with Capitol Ice just having a blast. Because I was always like, I was always in my head, like my voice is starting to crack. It's starting to crack, you know, and all day long, I would try not to talk, drink enough water,
oh my gosh.
You know, do vocal warmups before the show. I never got to really enjoy it because I was always in my head about, you know, what's going to happen when you blow your voice out in front of a couple hundred people tonight, you know, so.
Wow, that's so sad to hear you. Yeah. It makes me squirm a little to hear you explain it this way, because it's like, I mean, because you obviously love, you know, writing and singing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think, like I said, I think the studio was almost more fun to me because I didn't have to sing 10 songs all together one day in a set while jumping around and moving around and sweating and interacting with the crowd, right? There wasn't being a front man there. It was just me standing in the studio and doing different takes. And I loved that. I loved producing. I loved just the idea of being in the studio and arranging a song and working with Sprinkle, or even the second album where we didn't have Sprinkle and just like crafting songs. The art of it is really fun for me, but yeah, it's just on tour was stressful. Touring was so stressful. Yeah.
You know, it's pretty common more these days with the digital. There's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that people do digital, and it's possible to not tour and stuff like that. Do you think if you had been at a later time, you might have had more?
Yeah.
You know, if it was a time of let's just say Instagram Reels and stuff.
Yeah,
you,
exactly.
I could see if that you would have not necessarily had to be out on the road. You could have been expressing yourself in your native environment, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah, and I feel like I'm too old to do that now. But yeah,
what's that? What do you mean?
I don't know. I always feel like when I was 24, I felt like I was too old to be in a band. So now I'm 38. I definitely feel like I'm too old to be singing on YouTube. Although, but people tell me all the time, they're like, "Hey, you should have." If we were younger and YouTube and Instagram and all that was what it is today, yeah, definitely. Because we were filming ourselves all the time. We had a camera, the old camera back then, that the camcorder. We were always filming ourselves singing and harmonizing in the green room before shows. And we would run out on stage with cameras and film the crowd and like doing the selfie singing, like, whoa, you know, doing all that stuff. We just didn't have social media to post it on at the time. Uh-huh. So, but yeah, man, if we were a little later, or social media would have come a little earlier, shoot, that would have been great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people that can sing and play and love to do it, I think all ages are welcome on YouTube for that.
I know. It's just me telling myself I'm too old. But I agree. I follow people on YouTube that are way older than me that are crazy talented. Yeah.
Right. Wow. Man, this is really fascinating. What have you done for a career, and if you don't mind on the personal side, for somebody to, you know, do as much effort to be walk away from this scene, how would you describe the time since?
I'm in sales, corporate sales, selling business to business services, sales, basically human resources solutions like software. I could get into it, but everyone would turn off the podcast. It would bore you to death within a minute. But yeah, I'm in sales. You know what the crazy thing is I was doing this before the band got signed. I was more of an operations guy in the background, didn't talk to customers, just did some operational data entry stuff in the back end. After the band broke up, I came back and I was like, "Hey man, I've been a front man for a band. I was the one doing the interviews. I was the one talking on stage. I want to be the face of the company that I work for. I want to be like a sales guy. I want to be the one going out and visiting clients. I want to be able to shake hands, present PowerPoints, do all the nerdy stuff that we do, but I want to be the front man. I want to be the guy, the face of our company to clients." And
nice.
I moved into that role. I got my degree, moved into the role. Love it. Love what I'm doing. I work from home. So I'm in sales, corporate sales. Nothing to do with anything musically, but it definitely gave me the confidence I needed to be able to be in front of people and present to people. And
I can see that, how that makes sense. That's really cool, that experience of being in the band and from all the years really changed what your skill set is and your confidence that you got as a result of that, whatever you got. Like, that let you know that you are able to and worthy and, you know, and so then to take that and later on, because a thing that's really common in this way are people like you that seem to have a technical and a creative skill.
Yeah.
To be able to do both of those things.
It is,
And all the way to the beginning of the episode where you're saying is just go to the creative space to write that song or something. But, you know, and so that's interesting that how the skills from being creative and collaborative and traveling and all like actually add up to be skills that are valuable for anything.
Yeah. I remember when I applied for the sales job, they were like, "What sales experience do you have?" And I literally told them, when I was in a band, all we did was sold t-shirts for a living, sold CDs and t-shirts at the merch booth every night. And like, I was like talking about the creative ideas that we would have, like, you buy our t-shirt and our CD, or you can buy our CD, or you can pay $15 and buy ours and Run Kid Run CD. We would always come up with these creative ideas for to sell our merch. But I mean, it got me the job. They literally were like, "Well, it makes sense." And it got me the job. And I've moved into selling to bigger and bigger clients. And, you know, I travel out all over the place and visit clients face to face. I visited a client in Seattle a couple of years ago and booked a hotel downtown and walked over to the compound and was like, looking at myself in the reflection and took a picture, just getting nostalgic about the good times that happened there. And I sent it to Sprinkle. I was like, dude, look where I'm at right now. Cause he's in Nashville now. And he was just like, man, it's so cool. You know, see you back there. You know, it's fun, but I never really mix my current career with my old days, but it was fun to be able to do that and step out of the way from where I was visiting a client and actually just go down the street and visit the old compound.
Awesome. And are you doing anything musically? Do you own musical equipment? You own a guitar?
Nope.
Is there a guitar in your basement?
I've got an acoustic. I've got an acoustic guitar probably under the bed. I think it's under the bed. Yeah.
And last time you played it was how long ago?
My kids made me play a VeggieTales song for them probably 3 weeks ago or so. So
okay,
yeah, somewhat recent.
That's good. That's not very nice. I'm glad to hear that. Do you think your kids are, musically interested and will be talented?
I don't know. So they are ages 2, 4, 6, and 7. I've got 4 kids. Our 7-year-old and 6-year-old, maybe. It seems like possibly. Yeah, they're doing piano lessons. The 6-year-old, when he sings on key. So there's some hope there that maybe he'll have a voice. But yeah, maybe. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. Well, you have a lot of experience that they'll probably pick up from you. So
yeah.
Share there. So
yeah.
That's awesome. This is just really cool to be able to fill in the gap of somebody I've never met, but just, have some parallel experiences with. So
exactly.
I just really enjoyed it. So thanks.
Yeah, this is fun. I love nostalgia. I love nostalgia. So being able to talk about this with someone who also went through it was great.
Awesome. I think I'm out of control. I think I'm out of control.
Sweet looking around.